Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, August 7th, 2002. Today's session is titled, Nurturing the Moral and Spiritual Lives of Children, Participating in Music and Appreciating the Natural World. It is presented by Marcia Bungie. The number is BUM2002-08. Let's listen in.
We're looking at a couple each day. Today we're focusing on number three, on music and appreciating the natural world. So these are the questions I wanted to have in mind as we talk about some of this. And you might just look on that session three then. What have theologians, philosophers, and psychologists said about the power of music and the way it shapes the lives of children? I'm going to say just a little bit about Luther and Barth, how they talked about the transforming power of music, and just kind of some of your own ideas about the spiritual power of music. I want to just explore with you, do you think we can even talk about, are there good kinds of music for children, or is that almost a waste of time? Are there possible guidelines for determining what is the best kind of music for them, and is it even important to pay attention to that or not? There's kind of a debate about that, so I'd like to hear what your thoughts are. Why has the history of spirituality emphasized the importance of contact with the natural world? So I'll give a few examples from the history about how it's been seen as very important for moral and spiritual development. And what are some examples in the Christian tradition and today of ways that contact with the natural world has been a source of spiritual growth and inspiration? Can you confirm that in your own life? Are there examples you have in your own life or in the lives of children in your midst? And what are some of the ways that we could help cultivate a reverence for creation in children today? So those are some of the questions sort of keep in mind. And I thought I'd talk about, just say a few words, and you can jump in anytime. Feel free to just jump in.
The nature class is over there.
Oh, yeah, okay. To just promote a few ideas, and then generate a richer discussion. I thought one thing to start out with was just have kind of a thought experiment to help us think about why is it that music is so important in the spiritual life, and why is it contact with nature is so important. To imagine Holden, you know, just as it is, we're in this setting, we've got the same kind of food, the same kind of beautiful worship services, but no music. What would be missing if there were no music up here? Or if you try to imagine another thought experiment, looking at, you know, Holden, with the same food, same kind of worship services with the music. We have wonderful classes, but we hold it in a downtown Marriott. You know, what would be missing? What wouldn't we gain? What would be missing if we held it there? So that's just a thought experiment. Well, I just want to talk a little bit about music, and then feel free to jump in anytime. I think most of us know now the importance of music for child development. A lot of people are, you read about it in Newsweek and in Time, about all these studies of the positive benefits of music for children. For example, participation in music activities helps teach children discipline. It affects certain parts of the brain. We understand now that it's related to mathematical abilities. Children who are involved in musical groups learn about cooperation, they learn about discipline, they learn about working with other people. Some studies even point out the health benefits of singing or playing instruments, you know, such as using a kind of deep breathing, using the diaphragm, helping alleviate depression. And so music is being used in hospitals and clinics to help strengthen the process of healing among patients. So we kind of have that in our mind. And even though I think we appreciate the benefits of music, few of us might think about training children in music, training young people in music, and exposing them to particular kinds of music as really an important part of their moral spiritual development. You know, that we maybe don't always associate it quite with that, that's a really big responsibility of parents and of people who love children to expose them to music and to particular kinds of music. So, The people who reflected on music, philosophers and theologians, agree that music is very powerful. It's a very powerful force, and they describe its effects on human beings in a number of ways. They'll talk about its effect on our emotions, on our moods, on our memory, on our intellect and intellectual development, on our bodies and in effect on our health, and even our moral character. So when you look back at some of these philosophers and theologians who've written about it, they talk a lot about how it is very powerful, and that that's why we have to kind of pay attention to it when we're talking about the effect of music on children, because they believe, the ones who thought about it, in general, most of them believe it does have an effect on a child's moral and spiritual development. And a lot of them would say that music can be beneficial. This isn't universally so. It can be beneficial. But because it is powerful, you have to use it with caution. You have to pay attention to what's going on, what children are hearing. Oh, like Augustine, for example, says that music is one of God's greatest blessings, but he warns it can sometimes tempt us away from the world. Or Plato says, hails the positive benefits of music in moral development and social and political life, but he rejects certain modes of music because he believes they could have an ill effect on a person's moral character. Or even like John Calvin, he allowed hymns to be sung in the worship services, but he only wanted hymns based on the words of Scripture, and they could only be sung in unison. So, because otherwise it's going to be too powerful if you get too much harmony in there, or too many instruments. And like Luther, in contrast, encouraged the use of instruments and instrumental music in the world. And he was saying that if you want to spread the gospel, one of the most powerful ways you can do that is through music. So I've looked at a few theologians, and I put down some of the ideas they had about why music is so important, why it's so powerful. It's just a few ideas. I'm going to talk about four of them. And their ideas might help serve as guidelines for discerning do we even want to talk about what is good music for young people. Do we want to? And I really want to hear your ideas about that. But for these, just to get us going, the best kind of music does these four things. And I'll talk about each of them just a little bit. Heals emotions and renews us. It affirms life despite its complexities. It's not just, you know, la 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 kind of music. It can be very complex music to kind of express our grief, our disappointments, but yet in the end affirms life. It's a kind of music that affirms life in the end despite its complexities. Or it's music that transports the word to the heart and teaches important values and beliefs. And music that's very positive, too, also points to God's mystery. So, for example, Karl Barth is somebody who just loved Mozart. He would wake up listening to Mozart. He wrote a beautiful little book about Mozart and some little essays in the newspaper about Mozart. And he believed that his music was so powerful because it renewed him emotionally. It refreshed him. And he also had this sense that in Mozart you could see all this kind of discord and messiness and complexity in life, but in the end everything was affirmed. That for him, he said that Mozart kind of saw to the center of things, the essence of reality in some way, and saw its complexity, but in the end his music affirms life. And that's why he thought it was so powerful. He said, Mozart's music presents no less than the universe in all its discord. And despite this discord, an affirmation of life where joy overtakes sorrow without extinguishing it. So you can still see the sorrows, the disappointments, but in the end there's a kind of affirmation of life. And in an imaginary letter he wrote to Mozart this: "Whenever I listen to you, I'm transported to the threshold of a world which in sunlight and storm, by day and night, is a good and ordered world. Then I always find myself blessed with courage, not arrogance, with tempo, not an exaggerated tempo, with purity, not a wearisome kind of purity, and with peace, not a slothful peace. With an ear open to your musical dialectic, one can be young and become old, can work and yet rest, be content and sad. In short, one can live." Hmm. So, it really helped him write these volumes. Wow. You know, he has all the footnotes in his dogmatics to listen to that music in the morning. Wow. So that's what he had to say. And you get the same kind of thing in Luther, too, how music can be so healing for the emotions. It's a very, he talks about He praises music and criticizes anybody who didn't appreciate it as a blockhead, you know, in his subtle way, a fanatic, a stone, somebody who had no feeling at all. Because he said music is kind of a vital element of human existence. It's not just an ornament, not just a little entertainment, but vital to our existence. And in one passage, he praises the value of music and its positive effect on our emotions in this way. Experience testifies that after the Word of God, music alone deserves to be celebrated as mistress and queen of human emotions. No greater praise of music than this can be found, at least not by us. For whether you wish to comfort the sad, to terrify the happy, to encourage the despairing, to humble the proud, to calm the passionate, to appease those full of hate, and who could number all these masters of the human heart, namely the emotions, inclinations, and affections that impel human beings to do good and evil? What more effective means could you find to address these emotions than music? So he has that kind of sense too. It's a very healing, almost a kind of way to calm the emotions, you know, to kind of get you back in balance, kind of center you through music. He also said, though, that it's very powerful because, of course, it can transport the word to the human heart. It transports the gospel to the human heart and also teaches important values and beliefs. He calls music an instrument of the Holy Spirit and a very effective means of spreading the gospel. In many passages, he stresses the ability of hymns to transport the word of God into the heart and stir the soul. His belief in the power of music, of course, led him to write so many hymns, to have people really singing in the services, and that was a very strong part of the Reformation, is this tremendous participation of the lay people in the service through music, and this tremendous, generation of just tremendous amount of new hymns that came out of this period. He also talks about how important it is to do this with young people and to train young people in music. And in the preface to the Wittenberg hymnal, which was published in 1524, he says this: "It's good and God-pleasing to sing hymns. I think that's known by every Christian. For everyone's aware of the examples of the prophets and the kings in the Old Testament who praised God with song and sound and poetry and psaltery, and also the common and ancient custom of the Christian church to sing songs. And these songs that I've put in this hymnal are arranged in four parts, to give the young, who should at any rate be trained in music and other fine arts, something to wean them away from love ballads and hard songs, and to teach them something of value in their place, thus combining the good with the pleasing, which is very proper for youth, to put something fun and pleasing along with something valuable. Nor am I the opinion that gospel should destroy and blight all the arts, as some of the pseudo-religious claim. I would like to see all the arts, especially music, used in the service of God who gave and made them. I therefore pray that every pious Christian would be pleased with this and lend his help if God has given him life or greater gifts in music. As it is, the world is too lax and indifferent about teaching and training young people for us to abet this trend." So he really sees it as important work to train people in music. And I think this goes along with something we were talking about yesterday about the power of memorization, that if, you know, you're singing a song, you know those words so much easier than if you just memorize them without the music. That's, we were talking about the power of memorization, how it kind of gets into you, under your skin, if you've got it in a song. So I think that's part of this power of music as well. And then finally, people like Tillich have said that music is very important because there's something transcendent about it. It's so fleeting. It's finite. It has these notes that are there, and people playing for the instruments, it's very finite. But because it's kind of fleeting, it in a way transports us to something infinite. So a lot of theologians like Tillich will talk about how it is something that helps point to God's ultimate mystery. There's something interesting about music in that sense, that it points to something greater than yourself. And so that's another power that they mention. And if, you know, maybe these could be used as guidelines to talk about what's good music. What's good music for young people? That maybe it's a start in thinking about what kinds of music do you want to expose children to? Because they are listening to music. They're listening to it everywhere. On the radio, in these Walkman, you know, with CD players, MTV. They're hearing it all the time, and it's getting in those memory tapes, sort of the memory bank. We talked about this memorial library in your mind. So they're having something run through their mind. And do you want it to be, do you want to stick some things in there that, you know, might be more healing, affirm life, not create a kind of cynicism like some music does, affirm life, or maybe teaches some values and beliefs that are important to you or have something transcendent. Now, I just want to say a couple of qualifications because some people will say that, oh, they should just listen to so-called Christian music. Christian music is it. But that's hard to define, even if you look at Bach. You know, his sacred and singular were so kind of mixed up. And you wouldn't want to say, gee, you know, you can't even say what's the Christian Bach music, what's the secular Bach music. You can't quite do that. So I thought, you know, we don't want to just say, oh, Christian music is all you listen to, because I think there's a lot of wonderful music that does these kinds of things. And I think it also means, doesn't mean that you say, oh, you can never listen to, you know, some music that really maybe is highly cynical or full of hatred. That I think you want to listen to some of that music because it expresses people's questions, concerns. It teaches us about the contemporary situation. Tillich and Nathan Scott always talked about that, that you have to look at the arts around you because it's telling you what's going on in people's lives. And maybe the oppression and economic hardships or racism that's promoted this kind of hatred. But maybe you don't want to make it the full dose. It's all that kids listen to. And maybe we should just take a break here and just, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, do you think it's even, what other things have you thought about the power of music?
One of the things that just dovetailing on what you just mentioned about, I think there's something that is very important about music expressing the reality of experience. Mm-hmm. And sometimes church music, or sometimes I think music that has its origin in doctrine or a kind of prescriptive way things should be, and maybe part of the problem in terms of young people not getting into that is in part seeing this disjunction between mm-hmm. the experience of the world and this prescriptive notion about how things are supposed to be mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. how God is and all this sort of thing. And so, you know, what is authentic? Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, the rap music, the music that comes from the street experience is on the one end of that spectrum and saying to be truthful, you know, music's going to be truthful, it's got to reflect, it's got to come out of the genuine experience on the street, mm-hmm. whatever that may be, mm-hmm. however violent or whatever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I guess there's different ways of approaching that, you know, being true to experience, and yet if it's Christian music, I think there's a transforming element, there's some sort of redeeming or a transforming element there. You don't just start and end with the experience, the human experience, but there's another element there mm-hmm. that leads towards, you know, redemption or transformation in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
But you're saying to neglect that kind of music that does teach us something about the reality of people's experience is a problem.
I think young people are drawn to music that is authentic, that doesn't try to say, well, this is the way things are or should be, and at the expense of ignoring the reality, the dark realities that might exist. And so good church music should somehow be able to speak to human experience in its darkness, but not simply leave it there, but name another reality as well.
My girls are going to be 10 and 11. They're going into the age where music is really important. And music has always been important to them. They've been involved with choirs and instruments. And our family has a real wide variety of everywhere from rock and roll to classical music and everything in between Christian music. We like a little bit of it all, you know. And I find it's a wonderful opportunity because I listen to a lot of mainstream radio stations and some of the popular music out. And we'll sit there, we'll listen to the song. And my girls will ask me, so Mom, what does that mean? What are they trying to say? And we'll talk about the song, even though it may have some a lot of negative things about it. We'll talk about it. And it's just a wonderful opportunity. And so they're very open with just talking to me about music. And music's very powerful to them. And I love it when I hear them sitting there. You know, they'll be singing the Christian songs, and then they'll turn around, they'll sing a mainstream song, and they love it all, and it's just very important to them. It does, it shows life the way it is. We can't sugarcoat it.
Right.
And it just gives an opportunity to talk to your kids, I think.
I think it's so important to do, just to have a whole wide variety of music. I mean, I love almost every kind of music. I mean, there's a few kinds of music I'm not crazy about, and I know rap drives me crazy just because of the repetitiveness of it. Yeah. If I listen to the words, I can acknowledge it as some rap.
Yeah.
There's really meaningful words, you know. Right. But most, I mean, I love all kinds of music, and I am a first grade teacher, and I play music a lot in my classroom, and that has been very interesting because, you know, I'll choose what I think is good for whatever the activity is, you know, and it'll be conducive to, you know, working on some art project. And I had, over the years, I've had kids come up to me. This last year, I was playing something. I thought it was just beautiful. You kind of meditated. And a little girl came up to me and said, "Mrs. Kinnon, can you change music because that makes me feel like I'm going to cry." And I said, "Absolutely," you know. So I went over and put something else on. And sometimes they'll beg me for a certain song. Of course, they have their favorite songs, you know, and sometimes I want to play something that does not have words because I don't want to interfere. I don't want them listening to the words because it'll interfere with what they're trying to do. But so often I've had kids tell me emotionally how it's affecting them, and it's not what I thought, or it is what I hoped, you know, maybe one or the other. And I always respect that because I know how much it affects me, you know, emotionally. I'm so profoundly affected by music that I can't even play certain things when I'm at home alone just trying to work on the house because it might make me concentrate too hard, or it might make me feel sad, or it might make me feel, you know.
Or there's then that kind of music that helps you clean.
Exactly. It's like, how can you choose it carefully? Can be one or the other.
Motown.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, I think it's neat, you know, talking, that isn't really a good thing. People are talking, too, about television shows. They don't maybe like the shows always, but to talk about it with them, sit down with them and talk to them. But when you get too much, you know, if it's the only tape playing in their mind is, hey, baby, you know what I mean? Then you want some other tapes in there coming through that might nourish them, I think. And I don't know, I'm just amazed at what little kids, a 2-3-year-old, can memorize. Songs, you know, if they've watched a show a couple times. You know, it is amazing what's in their mind. What sort of comes out as they're playing, they're singing.
I have some concerns about the contemporary Christian music. Because we can be, I think, misled into thinking that it's all the same, that it's all of equal value and quality. And I think there's a lot of bad theology being sung there.
Right.
And really bad piety surrounding it. And bad, you know, that's a harsh word.
Right.
I have some concern about that.
Yeah. It's very popular. Like, even at VU, we have always had a rich kind of musical heritage. But one service they do have, they call it the contemporary service. And then that always sounds so bad, too. It's like, as if the rest isn't contemporary.
Right.
The rest is
exactly
old.
Yeah,
okay.
It's all contemporary.
But they have, I've gone to a couple of those now, and you know, where you put the overheads up. It's funny, it's almost like that's the genre too, where you have the overheads. But some of it is, it fosters more of a, it's a very me, some of it, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know, that's what I see. Well, I know in our church we have a contemporary, we have a traditional service or whatever, they try to alternate and everything, because we have a very young congregation with lots of young families, young kids. Really, that's the majority of our congregation. And I know that my children love the music and stuff of the contemporary service versus the mm-hmm. And so when we do go to other places that don't have it, they're like, you know, where's our music, Mom? You know. Yeah. But of course they know too that there's variety since we do have the alternating services and stuff. But it does appeal to the young. I mean, it does mm-hmm. appeal to the younger group. I mean,
it does.
One of the things that Marty Haugen, contemporary Christian composer of liturgies, and some of us are familiar with him probably. One of the things that he said in a workshop I attended that made a real impression on me was how a young man who had grown up in a church that he had served became a music director in his own church later on, and he told Marty with, I don't know if it was with pride, but he told him that, you know, he doesn't do any of those old hymns, you know, anymore. They just do the contemporary stuff. And Haugen realized that he had failed in teaching this young person, because he said, you really have to blend in all of those together. You cannot have a discreetly formed type of worship service that only has one element of music in it, because without that breadth, then you lose the deep rootage, you know, the transporting power of the word that is inherent in many of the texts of the hymns that are ancient but still very powerful. And here he had, you know, kind of segregated the music styles when this young man was growing up in his parish. And as a result, this young man now, as a music leader in his own parish, will do the same thing and will perpetuate and the great heritage of that hymnody and of the depth of that tradition will be lost upon mm-hmm. a new generation. Because that's all they'll be able to identify with. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so that, I think that certainly made me think a lot about, you know, the hymn selection and mm-hmm. the song selection that I do within the parish I serve.
Mm-hmm, yeah. That diversity, very good. Yeah, I think that, you know, historically and also just sort of worldwide, like that Lorraine Root, she's at our university now, and she has the most beautiful way of tying in, you know, a hymn from Africa, a hymn from, you know, from South America with a more traditional hymn. But you get this kind of sense, wow, it's worldwide, it's deep, mm-hmm. it's historical. You get the sense it's bigger than just your little community. Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
I think what I like about the Lutheran church is they do have the old liturgy is the same, and even mm-hmm. though you have contemporary songs, you still have that part of it that is old and is concrete. I'm part of my church's council, and as just a field trip, we went to a new church in Denver that was called The Next Generation, or The Next Level, I think is what, The Next Level. And it was a young church, I mean, it was college students, and they had 1,000 members at this church. And they had church on Tuesday night. It was just totally different, radical different. And their music was totally, you know, rock and roll Christian music, bands, and the kids, if you could have seen the wave of the congregation and the 1,000 members there, and I said, you know, whatever gets them there, that's good, you know.
Yeah.
But it was really interesting to see that and compare it with you know, other kinds of services I've seen in my life. So it was quite an experience, very energetic and, you know, powerful. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. The ELCA Division of Outreach did a study. A 10-year study of churches that offered a contemporary and a traditional service. in terms of how it impacted the life of the congregation, and notably in terms of membership. And the study revealed that it didn't change the membership statistics at all. Having a contemporary service did not increase membership or attendance at worship over a 10-year period.
Wow.
But what does increase it is quality. And I think that's part of what's going on in the contemporary movement, is that people are working hard to make it good.
Right.
And we just kind of have someone who plays piano at a fifth grade level playing the organ.
Yeah.
And it sounds lousy.
Right.
So it seems to me that what we need to do is train better musicians for all of the musics that we have.
Yeah.
And have, you know how often contemporary services will have in addition to possibly a band, they'll have song leaders, and they'll have maybe even a whole slew of them. Like my parents' church, it has four or five people up there leading songs. Well, you don't think of often of having even a song leader for more traditional hymns, or even like the African ones. There are a lot of what's in WOV, and yet, like in our congregation, there's a lot of people, there's a few real strong singers, and there's people who just hold back and sing. But if you just get one person, sometimes I can't stand, I'll just go stand at the mic. And I don't get real close, so I'm not like a solo voice, but just them standing up there singing, or someone's doing that, and people start singing.
Yeah. So which is exactly what a choir is supposed to do.
Right.
Yeah, and has been what a choir is supposed to do from the beginning of the church.
Right, that makes sense.
That's another problem with turning the choir into performance groups rather than worship leaders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our church is something very nice. I think they have only one setting of a liturgy for like 4 months. Mm-hmm. It's in all the services. And they just keep repeating that same liturgy. Mm-hmm. And they do it for the young people because they say that's kind of gets in their mind. Then they do the next setting. They do it at Marty Haugen. Mm-hmm. And then they do it at all services, and they do it that one. So it kind of gets in their mind, and it really, you know, our son is 9, but, you know, if he's bicycling or something, you'll hear him sing, as the grace of we, you know, he'll,
wow.
You know, and isn't that nice coming out instead of Pokemon or something?
Yeah.
Well, there's plenty of Pokemon in there. The Pokemon song. Maybe I'll say something just briefly about this, because maybe you have some ideas about this too, and then we can come back to music as well. But when you go back at this history of Christianity, it's so interesting too how important close contact with the natural world is for moral and spiritual development. It was so integral. You see it everywhere. You see it if you go back in the tradition. Of course, you see it in biblical passages like Genesis about the goodness of creation and God's delight in it, or the Psalms, the many passages of the Psalms that celebrate the beauty and diversity of creation, the book of Job, or those wisdom texts that talk about how human beings can learn from the natural world, both about how they ought to live, but something about God, or even the importance of going to the wilderness for spiritual renewal, cleansing, or insight is emphasized in the Bible, like in the Gospels. It's always interesting to me how it says Jesus was being led by the Holy Spirit. Jesus was led by the Holy Spirit into the wilderness. Mm-hmm. And then if you look back at the tradition too, beginning in the very early church, there's always been a very important role of very close, intimate contact with the natural world for spiritual growth, spiritual renewal. You see that in the early monastic movements. Celtic Christians, 5th through 7th century, saw nature not only as a very good thing, as a blessing from God, but as an expression of God. So they believed that contemplating the natural world was one way to open the door to a very intimate relationship to God. Or the medieval mystics found paying attention to nature and living in closer proximity to the natural world opened this door to a closer relationship with God. A lot of people know the story of St. Francis as one example, who developed this profound understanding of and compassion toward the natural world, and who still influences a lot of Christians today. And within this century, a number of Christian writers, theologians, and ethicists have written about the importance of contact with the natural world for moral, spiritual growth. Wendell Berry, Teilhard de Chardin, Sally McPhaig, Leonard Boff, John Cobb, Joseph Sittler, Paul Santmeier, Jürgen Moltmann, Larry Rasmussen, Rosemary Radford Ruther, all of those people have talked about the importance of the natural world I was even surprised. I went back, I was reading Dorothy Day's The Long Loneliness, you know, this very strong activist woman who just spent her life devoted to the poor. And you don't, right in the heart of New York City, and you don't think of her as, oh yeah, okay, nature woman, you know, who had to be in close contact to nature. But it's so interesting when you read that Long Loneliness. She was really, had started out with some interest in God and the church, but then she got very, very much an atheist, was very closely connected to a kind of Marxist movement, but wasn't about atheist. And but then she went and she lived on Long Beach, and she lived in this really remote area. It's just kind of interesting how she planted a garden, and she saw things growing, and she started asking herself, kind of just that miracle of the growth of that garden started making her ask herself, gee, maybe there's something bigger that I'm not aware of. And then she had a pregnancy, she had a daughter, and that pregnancy too was very spiritual for her, just seeing the wonder and that miracle of the growth of this baby inside her. So that was really interesting to read how that got her started. She wanted to start praising something, and that led her to go into the Catholic Church. Hmm. So that was sort of the turning point in her spiritual journey. So anyway, there's lots of examples today and in the past of how this has been so important, how close contact with the natural world is so significant for moral and spiritual development. And I tried to just put down some of the things you read when you look back at the tradition and at some of these writers today. A lot of them talk about how close contact with the natural world fosters an awareness of God's presence. There's kind of a stillness. There's a you get away from things, you get away from the phone, and there's just an awareness of God's presence. Or it promotes a sense of wonder of and reverence for life and creation. We lose a sense of awe, I think, a lot of times, and a sense of wonder. And a lot of them talk about how just looking closely at, even just like an ant colony, how wild that is, you know, kind of fosters this sense of awe and wonder about, wow, this is, or looking at a marsh and how complicated a marsh is and how long it's been around, and just all of how everything's so connected. My husband does all this work on loons and on certain kinds of butterflies, and they need certain kinds of flowers, and it's just so complicated and so interesting. Just looking at one little thing, it promotes the sense of wonder. Or a lot of them talk about how it fosters humility. You see something greater than yourself, something far vast. I mean, even if far vaster than yourself, like even if you look at the stars, we have a lot of astrophysicists too who are just kind of can't be atheists, some of them, because they see how big it all is. Even just here in Holden, the mountain, those big granite, I mean, it's something, isn't it? The mountains are so, it fosters a sense of humility or provides a sense of connection to something larger. And you start seeing we're all kind of one species in a way. You start looking at that, or you start seeing how we're dependent on other living things. You have a sense of connection to something bigger than yourself. Some have said also that because of that, it promotes a compassion for other people and all living things. Once you start seeing we're all connected in a certain way, all dependent on life around us, that you start to develop a compassion for other living things. I think one thing that's really important for young people today especially is that close contact with the natural world, or living in a more remote setting, going camping, really reminds you of your basic needs. And I think that's really hard for young people today when our houses are stuffed with possessions. You can't even, you know, I have students who think you cannot live without a hair dryer. You know, they couldn't imagine it. Or the big stereo system. It's hard to know what is a basic need when everything promoted to you is seen as you've got to have it, or you're something, you're not important, or you don't fit in. So just stripping that away and seeing, well, you know, you need the food, the shelter, the water, relationships. That's always very healing and renewing, I think, and very informative, especially in a consumer culture. A lot of people talk, too, about how once you kind of get a little clearer sense, you can clear your head about what are some of our basic needs, that it fosters a sense of responsibility for ensuring that the basic needs of others are met. or the basic need that you want to ensure that future generations can enjoy the things that you're enjoying. And that certainly we talk about how being outdoors is very healing and renewing. It's very renewing also for families. I like this work of this Mary Pfeiffer, who wrote Reviving Ophelia, mm-hmm. about anorexic girls. You know, she's written another book now about how families connect. And she prescribes, one of the things she prescribes is you need to go out as a family and go camping. And a lot of, oh man, we can't do it. They don't want to do it. But she says you have to do it. You know, I'll see you at the next session. Because she's doing this, you know, family counseling. And she thinks that it really has the power to heal and restore broken families mm-hmm. and helps families feel connected. She worries too many children today are staying indoors watching TV instead of learning the lessons that nature can teach them. She says, children need contact with the natural world. It's an anecdote to advertising. It gives them a different perspective on the universe. Looking at the Milky Way makes most of us feel small and yet a part of something greater. Television, with its emphasis on meeting every need, makes people feel self-important and yet unconnected to something greater than themselves. So I thought that was very interesting about how she says children find connection, complexity, going out with their families, camping. So in all these ways, I think attention to the natural world opens a door to a closer relation to God. As I think our witness of all these people I've been talking about in the tradition and our own experience tells us, nature can open a door to a sense of God's presence, God's goodness, God's ultimate mystery. I find it so interesting that a lot of the young people, when they talk about what's been a turning point in their spiritual life, these Bible camps are a big thing.
Yeah.
And I was talking to Jonathan Stranger, who's head of theological education at the LCA. They're going to do a study, too, of what's going on in these Bible camps, because a lot of the young people they find so great who are going to go on in ministry, ordained ministry, that's where they got the idea.
Yeah.
Started there. And we were trying to do that thought experiment again. Could you have had the Bible camp experience? Because certainly you're with peers. You're doing daily devotions. You have young people like yourself saying, hey, I think it's good to talk about God. You know, that's very powerful. But the setting, too, what is it about that setting? Could you have the same thing again in the Marriott, like we were talking about? What is it about that setting that prompts that?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, there's a lot of ways to do it. We can talk about that, but if we take this seriously and take the message of the tradition seriously, I think we'll be more attentive to saying that's a responsibility we have with young people, to be more intentional that way.
It seems like throughout Christian history there's been tension around the question of who we are primarily. Are we primarily spiritual beings?
Mm-hmm.
Are we primarily creatures? And maybe part of the answer to that is found in the phenomenon that we're just talking about now, or our experience of coming to a place like Holden. when we're closer to our origin, closer to the ground that
mm-hmm.
that we're formed out of, there's something powerful that can happen there. Maybe that's an answer to that question. Are we primarily, are we transcendent spiritual beings, or are we, somehow grounded? And not that it's an either or, but we spend so much of our lives, so much of modern life is spent disconnected from
mm-hmm.
the natural world, urban experience anyway. Not true in for a lot of our rural community, but to come back to that is to come back to something that we're deeply rooted in. I served Native American ministry in northwestern California for 5 years. Worked with several tribes in the area, and music. Both of these things were brought together in the sacred dance cycle that the Kanuk and Hoopa and Yurok tribes in particular, which with I was familiar, pulled together elements of that. And the, you know, there were specific dances, sacred dances, which were focused on, for example, healing a member of the community, and songs that were invoked that, you know, had the power to, you know, kind of set up boundaries so that, you know, nothing evil would be able to come in and touch this person or this child. And other sacred dances which rehearsed kind of the creation story for the tribe, so that there was a real unity of all the positive elements of music, as we've discussed it, and the natural world. There was just a you know, real oneness there. So I think there is perhaps some resources for us in the contemporary modern Christian community that exist in some indigenous communities that could be resources for us, but we're usually pretty critical about, you know, we usually see that as primitive, you know, but there's something very powerful when we're going back to an origin that we really share. It reminds us of our creaturehood, you know, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think that's partly why for some people that's not that comfortable to be reminded of it, you know, kind of your vulnerability. But that's part of the discomfort with getting out there more. I think, too, you know, it's like you can start almost anywhere, too, even if you live in a very urban setting. I think you can start anywhere just by talking about what are we eating? Where's the food coming from? What's in this food? Where did it come from? Like, Holden's so aware. You know, you gain an awareness about where your food's coming from. You are eating things that are grown somewhere, or just getting to know a sense of place. I've been doing some work with, the Hastings Center has a thing on nature poles and ethics, and there's a big group in Chicago working together, and they have this Chicago Wilderness Society there, and you know, you don't think about Chicago as, okay, the place we're going to get to know this, but they've really tried to look at neighborhoods and try to get to know, you know, your little neighborhood, your bioregion, and a lot of good things are happening out of that in Chicago.
Hmm. I've heard of lots of things. You know, one of the reasons we moved to Colorado is we wanted to be in nature. I'm big on it, and we drag our kids everywhere in nature, camping and stuff. But we see a lot of inner city kids will come out into, they'll have the special camps for them out. We've got a Lutheran Rainbow Trails in Colorado. That's one of these youth camps that you were talking about, that they just come and, you know, and experience something like Holden, except for the youth level. It's great. My kids came back the first year this year, and they were we want to do Bible study every day, Mom. And it's just all this positive stuff came from it. It was wonderful. But we also see a lot of the inner city kids will be taken up to these camps too, and the awe, you know, that they have, they're like, wow, you know, rivers, you know, trees, you know, it's just so powerful and healing for them. And of course you hear about all the kids in trouble that are brought out to the camps, and how healing that is for them to sit in backpacking for 2 weeks, you know, and be connected with nature. There's no arguing, it's powerful.
Yeah, for young people, they have those, you know, camps like with horses. Just getting to know a horse is very healing for a lot of disturbed young people. Or like you say, these camps that are out more, where you have to kind of exert yourself, get back again to basic needs. What are some basic needs we have to survive? Were there things you would add to this list or that list?
It's interesting that they are related, if you think about it. And I especially liked your first qualification, Marcia, that it's really hard to distinguish sacred and secular. I think, for example, in the mind of Bach, there was no distinction at all. It was hard for him to tell when an Italian concerto began and a church can taught to stop.
Yeah.
You know,
it
was all kind of blended together. Mm-hmm.
I found, you know, these two things, when we look at our college students, we were writing this big vocation grant. I was the director of our, a big grant we got from the Lilly Endowment to help young people think about their vocation. And so we were talking to a lot of young people. And what's so interesting, they talk about Lutheran summer camp, that music camp, Lutheran summer music program. Where that has been very powerful for a lot of them. Or we talk to young people who are in our choirs, and it's not set up, the choir isn't set up so you're not even going to have some moral spiritual formation here. You know what I mean? It's like, hey, join the choir, I always sing. But they get in there, and it's partly the music, but the fellowship you have, and then the kind of harmonies you create with one group, your little voice, with the bigger group, the cooperation, but also just the music. The music, it makes them ask some new questions, or if they're singing it in the service, and a lot of them haven't, you know, had a good relationship to the church or got out of the church, but then they start singing it in the service, and they start to ask some questions about their own faith or their relation to the church. And we can't prove it, but we wanted to say almost that we think most of our lay leaders that have come out of VU have been involved, highly involved in these music programs. So interesting. Or then you talk to young people. I taught this class on children, the family, and faith, and oh, it was so funny. We've been around the room. And in our honors college, we always have a kind of small group, 15 or under is in every class. We went around the room, and we're just talking about issues of faith and growing up in the families. And so many of them talked about their experience at places like Holden, or this Camp Arcadia, which is in Michigan, or is it called Outlaw Ranch or something like that in South Dakota. Yeah. How that brought so much family connection. It allowed their family to help, I don't know, express their faith more in a sort of a communal way, but brought help them when they got back home. Mm-hmm. And I was just amazed, these young people, tremendous leaders, all of them talking. It was almost funny. It was almost getting redundant. You know, it's like, what has moved you in this way? Well, it was my experience at this camp, you know?
Yeah. Wow.
So
I once met this lady that while we were camping once, and I think I was dragging my girls along on a hike, and she says, you know, when my kid boys were little, same thing, I had to carry them up the hikes, you know, everywhere, they whined the whole way. But now that they're grown up, they talk about those trips, and that they have the most wonderful memories. In fact, so much it influenced them that they moved to Colorado. They moved into the mountains, you know, and became very connected. But, you know, you may not know it at the time when they're crying all the way up there.
Right.
How powerful it is.
And there is, you know, there's maybe another connection I'm toying with here in my mind about music and a positive contact with the natural world. And that is that there is a discipline behind each one of those as well. You think of the finest expressions of music, there's a tremendous amount of dedication and discipline that led to that expression. I'm thinking that you were talking about choral experience. I was thinking of my own choral experience and how that was very true for me as well, being part of a group that is that is disciplined in its work, and that yields something greater out of that. John Krakauer, who wrote Into Thin Air, also wrote another book about a young man who went up to Alaska, I think it was Alaska or Canadian wilderness, somewhere in it, up in the wilderness, and had this image of himself being able to live off the land and survive. Well, he lasted a couple of months, and he died out there. Mm-hmm. And John Krakauer tells this story about, you know, what happened to this young man and how his assumptions about what that wilderness experience would be were very different from the real experience of having to try to survive, and how he wasn't equipped. He didn't have the disciplines that had prepared him to really live in that context.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think discipline is an element that that leads to a certain kind of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
You think of the best artists, musical artists. I think these are people who have achieved such a, you know, after years of discipline work, have achieved a level of creativity that they have tremendous freedom in how to express and to explore things. But
mm-hmm.
the basis of that is a certain kind of discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's true in the natural world too. There was a young man here, you know, we live on the edge of the wilderness here. And it's very tempting when you have ice cream every night and so on to think that, you know, we're not on the edge of the wilderness. But people have died here. People have
died
on the trails. You know, a young man nearly lost his life in 1996. I happened to be in the village at the time, down here by Ten Mile Falls. And so, you know, you forget that.
Mm-hmm.
But there is an underlying, there are rules,
yeah.
I guess, that underlie, and when we attend to those kind of basic rules, then they will yield a harvest.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's part of something that's larger than us, too,
mm-hmm.
because we can get so curved in on ourselves that, you know, we want to have the end without taking the time
mm-hmm.
to go through
mm-hmm.
the steps.
Yeah.
And so there are steps in each one of those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a discipline.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I think also, you know, connected with that discipline is that humility. It is, you know, we kind of think we can
yeah.
go out there and
yeah.
just sort of do anything.
Yeah.
But there's some limitations as human beings, as finite creatures. And so it does require that kind of discipline. I think what's really hard now is there's a lot of obstacles to these sort of things right now. Like, because music is so available, you're listening to it all the time, and it's beautiful and everything, but there's a sort of sense, either you got to be that great or it's sort of nothing. That's sort of one thing. Or then with, you know, the nature shows, I think, are so great, but they kind of give you the sense when you get out there, it's going to be so exciting. But, you know, it takes a while to see these things happen, you know. They had to sit there for hours and hours to get the copulation of the lions, you know what I mean? You kind of think, and then I think these commercials with, you got to have your SUV.
Oh.
And you got to have the equipment, you know, to get out there. That it's almost like you've got to possess, consume, so you can get out to simple nature, you know what I mean? That's the kind of a... drags people in, I think, too.
I would like to know one person who owns an SUV, probably maybe in this room, I don't even know, who actually drives that, who owns it because they actually drive it on the kind of roads shown in the commercial.
Yeah.
People drive
yeah.
them on
yeah.
highways and
right.
in the city, and they think they need them, and they don't.
Yeah.
It's so ridiculous. They should drive on these mountains. It's like, nobody does that.
Yeah.
You know, if they do, they probably have some old beat-up
we,
car.
We tried it once, and
did
it wasn't
you?
A good idea. I use it for the snow, mostly.
You live in Colorado.
Yeah,
Colorado.
I think the snow. I've got gravel and stuff.
Yeah.
But
one of the things, Marcia, that you said that I think our children showed us was when they were teenagers, they went to like these Synod conventions
yes.
for the youth and this kind of stuff. And they were in a hotel in Duluth or they were in a hotel in Rochester or whatever. And they came back and yes, it was great, but... and they never particularly sang the songs afterwards or, you know, this kind of stuff. There was not a lot of discussion. But when they went out to shores of St. Andrews
mm-hmm.
or, you know, out there, I mean, they come back with a whole different
mm-hmm.
thing.
The kids
in the camps. Those are the camps.
That's interesting,
and
isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, they shared in both. I mean, they were participated in both. But there's a whole different feeling. We now, in our church, basically require, I mean, the program, we're members of the Green Lake Bible Camp Association now, and we have a tremendous number of kids that go. We take busloads out there for camp, and this is something that didn't, you know, wasn't going on there for a few years. And we require a certain amount of camping with our confirmation program,
mm-hmm.
retreats or confirmation camp or
mm-hmm.
a retreat weekend. you know, somewhere else and those kinds of things. And it's a whole different thing. Kids have been in hotels. Mm-hmm. I mean, right. I don't think there's very many kids around today right. that have not been in hotels.
Mm-hmm.
But they, you know, to be up here, they've all been up here to Holden. Mm-hmm. Last year we had 27 of us up here.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Just our kids. Wow. Kids and grandkids. Mm-hmm. But they... This is a whole different thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and just as and this is a personal example, but one of my granddaughters, who is 7, said, I told her we were coming back to Holden this summer, and we had her up at our lake place and with the family and stuff, and she says, well, what do you think of the new place at the lake and stuff? And she says, oh, it's really nice, Grandma, but it's only second. Because Holden is best.
Mm-hmm.
And she's only been here once.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most of our other grandkids have been here 2 or 3 times, but this was a first timer last summer.
Wow.
And Holden is already first on her list.
Isn't that something?
And our 3-year-old said, I said, we're going to Holden. And he was here when he was 2. He says, Holden Village? And I said, yeah. And he says, Mom, let's go get some ice cream.
I think it's stripping away. It's sort of stripping away. You just get away from some of the rush of the TV.
Yeah,
they don't have the TVs here. I don't know what it all is.
I think there's something about the heart. I don't mean hardship because I mean hardship as compared to traditional middle class America.
Mm-hmm.
Our kids living they're not the world's worst or best, whatever, all these computer games that they play in front of the mm-hmm. television set and all this kind of stuff. But just 2 quick comments. One is that even with my children, who are now in their late 30s, early 40s, they, when they were growing up in a neighborhood, everybody was outside playing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We had a television set, but you walk to a neighborhood and everybody was outside playing.
Yeah.
If you go to a neighborhood now,
like a ghost town.
You seldom see them outside playing.
Yeah.
But with those same kids, and we restrict all of our children, all the grandchildren are restricted on the amount of time in front of TV
mm-hmm.
and playing the computer games and mm-hmm. all this kind of stuff. But you put them up here, and we banned. They were not allowed to break anything. That they could do this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know that not one of them even asked?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They don't complain. Not. Like our 2 cousins are really hooked on TV. I mean, tremendous. And the grandparents have a cabin where they have no TV. There's no TV allowed. So they thought they were going to die. But gosh, within a day, they didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
So something. I do think these 2 things are a little bit more neglected than like the other ones I've been talking about, like a good example, service project rituals, reading the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
These aren't as emphasized as much mm-hmm. as really key formative kinds of activities with young people, but I think they are. So,
I think another point that we need to realize that I don't know if even society is invested in these 2 things, because we do cuts in education.
Where are they?
Right,
the arts. Right. Well, gosh, thank you so much for
your
time.
Yeah.
And
I often wonder, and they do know about this. Luther's last name comes from the word for meat maker.
Good.
So even a person who repairs guitars today is called a luthier. I often wonder whether there's some kind of musical heritage
mm-hmm.
in his family.
In his own family.
Yeah, because he played the lute.
Right, he did. I know he played the lute. I don't know, I think it's so great we have that as part of our tradition. So strong, isn't it? Our son is now in this parochial school at Emmanuel,
Yeah, right. You were telling us about that. And the choral program.
Yes.
Yeah.
Extended strict, hey, man, you move muscle. You get no recess. But why they get so much out of that? I love that we have that part of our heritage. Like, some churches don't as much,
Yeah.
Some denominations.
Well, it was a good discussion.
Yeah, it was.
Thanks, Marcia.
Mm-hmm.